Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
That probably comes from the fact that we are federal land permittees. So we deal with a lot of regulations on a daily basis. It actually feels like more of our time is probably spent dealing with red tape than with cattle some days, which is incredibly frustrating.
Idaho cattlewoman Kim Brackett.
We run cattle in Idaho and Nevada, and we run cattle on BLM and Forest Service. So that gives me four different agencies, two in each state, plus the federal agencies that we have to make our management decisions based against those regulations. So it gets very overwhelming. It gets very expensive. The threat of litigation is always over our head. We have constant litigation from environmental groups in this area. So it's increasingly expensive to manage around that.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I come to represent producers, backgrounders, and stockers, because that's the part that I'm involved in.
William Ruffin is with Ruffin Farms, Bay Springs, Mississippi, before the Senate Ag Committee on Tuesday.
I come here to tell you what's going on in the pastures at home. And I will tell you that I'm passionate about the cattle business. I've been in the cattle business my entire life. If you read my bio on my submitted testimony, you'll see that I've been involved in it my entire life. I do have a sideline of practice in law, but I assure you the part of my tax returns where I lose the most money is in the cattle business. So I have a definite interest in that. But I guess probably where it first hit home to me about what was happening to the marketing system in this country was back in the 70s, and it actually took place in Senator Grassley's state. In Iowa, I had a connection there where I could sell cattle, small groups of cattle, maybe 2-3 loads, to just independent farmers who had a bin full of corn, and they would take that corn and sell it through my steers and heifers that I sent them, and it was a good relationship. They paid a fair price. They made money. I made money. Everybody was happy. Well, toward the end of the 80s and 90s, all of a sudden, that market dried up. And I was talking to my man there, and he says they don't have anywhere to sell their cattle. The packer ownership, the AMAs, they don't have any place to sell those cattle. I mean, the formula cattle and all have taken them away, and they don't have a place to sell them. So I lost that market. Well, if you're in the cattle business, you have to be resilient. So I move on from there, and I move on to where I call a group of we call them order buyers, they're commission sellers. I call them to sell my cattle. I have a group of producers that we pool our cattle together, and we try to sell those cattle through a group of commission sales, which would be probably 5 or 6. All of a sudden, the first thing I realize is I'm only getting 2 bids. I ask them why. Our cattle are sold in the markets in northern Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, southern Kansas. And the reason is because there's no cash market there. I'm emphasizing that we've got to have a cash market. We've got to have the opportunity to sell our cattle, and that's the way we sell them. All of the competition is taken away. Now, I only talk to one buyer, and I have to try to guess because I don't have the information really determine whether I'm getting a fair offer or not. I only have one buyer. And I dare say that if we don't pass this bill where we have some transparency in this and we don't make an effort to reestablish the price, the cash price, I'm not going to have any. When that happens, I'll go the way of most of the producers in this business. We've lost probably somewhere around 12,000 in the last 20 years in my home state. Our state had around 2 million cattle in 1970. Now we have maybe 800,000. So there is a problem. And the problem all started taking place when we got consolidation of our packers and we got consolidation of markets and the AMAs came in. So I'm an advocate of this bill. I realize it may not be perfect, but I do think that we've got to do something, because if we continue to do nothing, which is what most of the opponents of this bill say, we're going to keep getting the same results. And I would seriously consider that you take that this bill may not be a lifesaver, but I think it might be throw us a life raft anyway.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Madam Chairman, I am going to say unequivocally that New Jersey is not America's biggest beef producing state.
I'm so glad you clarified that.
Cory Booker is a senator from New Jersey. He's a member of the Senate Ag Committee.
I think it's very important to know, but I will say this, in all of America, there is no vegan more passionate about fighting for American ranchers than me.
All right.
Our ranchers are not getting justice in this country. I want to sign on to what Senator Lujan says. It is utter deception to American consumers that we don't label products of the USA as products of the USA. You let Mexican cattle come into our country, be processed by these big multinational corporations, and be labeled as products of the United States of America. That is outrageous. That is lying to consumers. That is deceptive practices. And it should end because ultimately it's hurting American ranchers.
Booker, at a Senate Ag Committee hearing on Tuesday on transparency in the cattle markets.
The stunning thing that my colleague from Nebraska said, I just don't understand how stunning what she said is, but we're almost normalizing it. I found the same thing when I visited with American ranchers in Illinois. The fact that they are afraid to come here to testify because of the outrageous power of these consolidated meatpacking companies is just a testimony to the unacceptable inaction of Congress over the last decade or two to allow these meatpacking companies to continue to consolidate. And they have reason to be afraid. As Senator Tester said, 40% of U.S. cattle producers have gone out of business, not because they're not good business people, but they've gone out of business because of this incredible corporate consolidation. Nearly half of our ranchers have been forced to sell their herds and their land that in many cases has been passed down for generation and generation by their families. These are great American entrepreneurs being forced out of business by this growing consolidation of these multinational corporations. Four of them, four meatpacking companies, Tyson's, Cargill, JBS, and National Beef, have corrupted the marketplace using unfair and unlawful practices. This has got to stop.
At the end of the day, he's pleading for bipartisan support.
We have seen the devastation to farmers in the poultry and pork industries that happens when big packers take control and pervert our free market system. And unless Congress acts quickly, that is where the beef industry is now headed. So I'm glad that we're here today talking about solutions to this problem, but I am concerned that Senate Bill 4030 does not go far enough to address the dire state of cattle markets today. And so I look forward to the opportunity to continue working to improve this legislation as it moves forward. And while the bill gives the USDA 2 years for implementation, I would hope that the USDA will move much more quickly given the emergency situation that exists in our cattle market. I have talked to incredible cattle ranchers who are struggling to stay in business right now. 2 more years of the current system is so unfair.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There are optional inputs. For example, not every year you're going to need a fungicide on a corn crop. You know, for us, sometimes the blight comes in late enough, there's really no yield benefit of putting on a fungicide application.
Danny Morris is an agricultural economist, University of Tennessee at Martin.
I would say there's choices that you choose. You know, you can get your cost down by choosing whether we use trade name or generic. Foliars, a lot of producers look at foliars as optional. That we can skip that application. It might not have as much of a high yield, but at the same time, that lowers our cost. We can switch out a few things. So, yes, I think there are a lot of things that are optional that they can choose to not do. It may come at the cost of a little bit of higher yield, but it does lower their overall per unit cost. And they have to be cognizant of that, because if you don't hit that high yield that you're chasing by using this additional input, then you spent that money and you didn't get a bang for your buck.
David Widmar is co-founder of Agricultural Economic Insights.
I think of it as putting together a playbook. And so some years you might look ahead and say, what are some management decisions I want to make on the fly? Sort of what are the calls that the quarterback might be able to make through an audible? So they line up at the line of scrimmage and you have your best plans and you see the defense or the year ahead of you making some adjustments. And in some parts of the country, it could be fungicide. In other parts of the country, they might know, I need to have a fungicide on my corn every single year. It's a question of, do I add a second fungicide pass? It's going to be very unique for every producer across the country. But I think, you know, you got to think about what are those decisions what are those levers I can pull in the growing season? There's a great quote, it comes from Eisenhower. It's, you know, planning, I'm going to butcher this quote a little bit, but it's planning in itself doesn't create a lot of value because all of our plans fall apart. But the process of planning allows us to pivot whenever we get punched in the face. And so this idea of how do you create these options that you can deploy as the growing season unfolds and as things don't go as the plan, which is always the way it happens.
And then there's Brady Brewer, Purdue University assistant professor and ag economist.
When you think about budgeting, the traditional budget that we do in agriculture is we do all of our farm budgets on a cost per acre basis. Okay, that's great. What I'm going to argue is that we need to be thinking a lot more on a cost per bushel basis. Most other industries, the main budget they do, and I keyword there main, other industries do budget like we do on a cost per acre or cost per input basis, but the main one is going to be on an output, right? So cost per bushel. Every bushel is not created equal. The first bushels you produce are going to be more costly because you're spreading out fixed costs. Then you're going to hit an optimum, and then eventually you're going to be putting enough inputs into it, whether that be fixed or variable costs, that your cost per bushel starts going up again, okay? And at some point, it's going to reach a point where you may be, that bushel may cost you more than what you get for that bushel, okay? That would be, you know, the ultimate no-go. You don't want to get to that point, okay? What I'm arguing is that we need to think more on a cost per bushel basis, okay? When you're adding that fungicide, what is the revenue I get on a per bushel? This is costing me, if I think my yield for corn is going to be 180 bushel per acre or whatever yields are in your area, if I think this is what my yield is going to be, it's costing me X amount per bushel and this is what I get in return, right? If I get a 5 bushel per acre return, okay? Thinking like that, I think, would help, would be beneficial.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The vast majority of cattle producers oppose government mandating a minimum level of negotiated trade.
Sean Tiffany is president-elect of the Kansas Livestock Association before the Senate Ag Committee on Tuesday.
In February, members of NCBA adopted policy opposing government mandates on cattle marketing methods. KLA joined with 29 other NCBA affiliates in a letter to this committee expressing opposition to marketplace mandates. In January, the American Farm Bureau Federation took a position in opposition to marketing mandates. Having participated in both the KLA and NCBA policy process, I can tell you those members overwhelmingly believe cattle producers should have the opportunity to market their cattle how they see fit without arbitrary limitations imposed by the federal government. Tiffany Cattle Company is a custom cattle feeding business. What that means is the cattle in our feed yards are owned by other cattle producers. They place their cattle with us, and we provide feed and care during the finishing phase. One of the services we provide our customers is marketing their cattle when they are ready for harvest. We work with multiple packers using several different marketing methods to maximize the value our customers receive for their high-quality cattle. A mandated minimum level of negotiated trade will limit my ability to maximize the value my customers receive for their cattle. Furthermore, a mandate on the packers will force packers to discontinue some alternative marketing programs to meet minimum negotiated trade mandates. Which of my customers will lose their ability to access value-added marketing when this occurs? Neither myself nor my customers will be given the option to choose because the mandate and the power to comply with the mandate will rest with the packer. Cattle producers themselves have gravitated towards the use of AMAs. There are many reasons for this. AMAs allow a cattle producer to capitalize on the investments in improved genetics and production practices on their ranches. AMAs allow the cattle producer to capture more of the value when their cattle yield beef products with attributes that the consumer is willing to pay for. My brother and I built our first generation business from 10 customers to over 200 customers by having access to quality-based premium programs. Not only has our own business grown, but those of our customers as well, because AMAs have allowed them to be paid for the exceptionally high-quality cattle that they raise. My typical customer has fewer than 200 cows and will retain ownership of their calves in order to receive the true value for their efforts, and just as importantly, to receive the carcass data back from the packer so they can continue to make improvements in breeding decisions back at home. Tiffany Cattle Company is also engaged in efforts to produce beef with lower total greenhouse gas emissions. This program requires an AMA to facilitate the supply chain coordination necessary to connect these products to consumers willing to pay for that certification. We also feed a high percentage of non-hormone treated cattle and natural program cattle. These labels rely on AMAs to ensure the cattle producer who has taken on the additional expense of gaining that certification is assured access to a market willing to pay for that added value. In conclusion, increased use of AMAs is correlated with improved beef quality. When packers pay for quality, farmers and ranchers are incentivized to produce it. In the year 2000, about 60% of fed cattle graded choice or better. Today, that number is more than 80%. In my own operation, we have averaged 92% choice or better in all marketings for the last 10 years. That improved quality has led to better beef feeding experiences, which has led to increased consumer demand for beef both domestically and internationally. AMAs have helped the cattle industry better meet consumer preferences, and consumers are gravitating towards our beef because of the high quality and the unique brands we have developed. I ask Congress not to limit my use of AMAs, which have helped make these quality improvements possible.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We look back over history, and a lot of times we think about this regulatory process as a cycle of 2 or 3 or 4 years, and we go back and forth and back and forth in this regulatory whiplash.
Caitlin Glover heads up the Public Lands Council talking about waters of the U.S.
But one of the things that I think really catalyzed this issue for me and for a lot of our colleagues this week was that over the last 50 years, cattle producers and other resource managers have had to deal with 13 different iterations of what is considered a water of the United States. Now, I think we're really looking to the Supreme Court and to this administration to listen to us about the tests that need to be used, the process that needs to be used to determine what is jurisdictional for federal regulation. But the filing this amicus brief is certainly an opportunity for us to elevate that conversation. So I take that as some good news, but we do have, you know, still a bit of road ahead, or stream ahead, as it were, before the issue is fully resolved.
She also talks about the importance of clarity and certainty.
You know, that clarity and certainty is really important. And, you know, for a lot of our cattle producers, a lot of our land managers, the constant refrain is that, the government just needs to let us do the good work that we're doing, right? And what that really comes down to is that federal regulations need to be flexible enough to allow the good work that cattle producers do, to allow that to proceed, right? And so just like WOTUS, where we've been hearing about this repeal and replace and sort of this whiplash, the same thing is happening in NEPA. So the National Environmental Policy Act, as many of us know and as many of our producers know, sort of underpins really a lot of the work that happens in the resource space nationwide, right? Everything from, in the West, renewal of a federal grazing permit, or even authorizing restoration and remediation activities after a wildfire. But also, you know, the construction of roads and bridges and really important transportation infrastructure that allows folks to get those cows across the country where they need to go to make sure that we have an efficient supply chain. For a long time, we knew that the NEPA process was inefficient, right? Things have changed since the 1970s and regulations need to be able to change and adapt with that current need. And so in 2020, the Trump administration promulgated new government-wide guidance, essentially saying that NEPA has to be faster, it has to be more targeted, more efficient, and it needs to be returned to that original concept, right? That NEPA is a process to evaluate, not a tool for perception of judging whether a project is good or bad. Now, that government-wide guidance was finalized in 2020, and we knew pretty early in this administration that it was going to be on the chopping block. So this week, the Biden administration finalized the first in a two-stage rulemaking process to roll back that 2020 guidance, to go back to that pre-2020 standard, make the considerations of impacts a lot more broad, and then they're going to be promulgating their own fix to these problems. You know, by the administration's own admission, they know that pre-2020 NEPA was inefficient. It took too long. The analysis was too complicated. The scope was far too broad. It failed to consider important factors like local expertise, local input, socioeconomic and economic data. And so this phase two is really where the rubber is going to meet the road in terms of what it means for cattle producers. But this first stage, this return, this sort of reseeding to a position that we know is ineffective, it is really, really disappointing.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Part of that strength in the sorghum market may have to do with a week in which we had strong exports.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien on sorghum.
For the week ending April the 14th, exports of about 11 million bushels. And again, we kind of bounce around the sorghum. We have one or two down weeks and then strong weeks. Well, we've had having several pretty good grain sorghum export weeks in a row, but I think this 11 is near the top of what we've seen here of late. So we need a pace of about 6.6 million bushels to meet the USDA's projection. So with that type of pace, you do wonder about in that May report coming up, if we'll see the USDA increase the export numbers for grain sorghum. You would wonder with the pace we've been seeing and tighten up ending stocks a little bit. So we'll see where that goes, and that may also be the case, again, depending on what we see coming out of South America with some crop concerns emerging for second crop corn, even some dry areas, Mato Grosso in particular, and that being one of the issues along with Ukrainian shortfalls that's holding up these tremendous corn prices, that the USDA probably will come in and be forced to make some adjustments on usage and probably to the higher side on some of these crops, particularly corn and grain sorghum on the export side.
And talks about soybean sales.
Well, they had crop problems, you know, that lessened their crop in South America, and there aren't that many places in the world that sell soybeans. We had a pace for the week ending April the 14th of about 33 million bushels. Need about 21 million to meet the USDA's forecast, so very likely that the pace of exports from now to the end of this mark and that's anticipated could probably force the USDA to raise their export number, tighten ending stocks again. And when you look at soybean ending stocks in the United States, they're projected to be for this marketing year that we're in at about 6.5%. We have been down to about 2% before, but these extraordinary times that we're in probably forcing the USDA's current marketing year numbers ending August 31st down closer yet to that 2 and 3 area when they had, I wouldn't say it's a comfortable margin, but at least they weren't at 2 or 3%. They were at 6.5% and very, very likely to see things tightened up.
And then there's the market that keeps moving higher, wheat.
We had a decent hard red winter wheat marketing week this last week, better than we had been having, about 7 million bushels. We're still behind the USDA's projection for what we need to get to the end of the market year, but 7 million bushels, better than what we had been seeing of 3 or 4 per week. Overall, still some market disappointment, apparently, on not seeing the Ukraine-Russia challenges force more U.S. wheat sales. And again, I don't doubt that day will probably come, given the challenges they're going to have getting any wheat out of Ukraine that in a timely manner in quantity. But when that day comes, we'll say, well, boy, then we'll really have hot markets. But how do we not say we have hot markets already when you're looking at July futures at 11.43.5? Does that mean we go higher? It's possible. Once you actually see the business do come to the U.S., which it seems it's destined to do someday, then where do the wheat markets go? They're already at 11 plus. all the way from the May contract, May 22 to May 23. So that compounded with dry conditions. You see the U.S. drought monitor map running right from South Dakota all the way down to Texas. All those states in tough shape. I think we've got numbers showing that 70% of the winter wheat acreage in the U.S. is in drought, severe drought. So tough times. It'd be a great time for rain to come. It would probably hurt prices a little bit, but we need the bushels, basically.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is involved in watershed restoration, irrigation dam management, and flood prevention. Yet as Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Robert Bondi pointed out in March, much of the infrastructure supporting these projects is aging.
And we've developed a backlog of structures that need to be upgraded, that need to be improved, that need to be repaired.
USDA Thursday announced a $420 million investment to go towards 132 infrastructure projects in 31 states. Projects are covered under two NRCS programs, Watershed and Flood Prevention Operations for Watershed Technical and Financial Assistance, and the Watershed Rehabilitation Program to upgrade existing NRCS-managed dams. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, making the announcement in Georgia, says these investments will both help communities rebuild after disasters and prepare for future events. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.